This episode of AV Excel was recorded on December 18th, 2017. So much good stuff, people. We're going to talk about the TV deals to aim for if you missed Black Friday. Amazon Prime finally on the Apple TV. Yes, we still prefer Blu-rays, home settings for your AV receiver, and a viewer review. Chris writes in with a review of his new shit. All that, and yes, there's a little content pick action going for you if you're looking for eyeball and ear candy. All that and more coming up on AV Excel.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. All right, I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Welcome to AV Excel, your guide to the best in home theater gear and audio, no matter what your budget is. My name is Patrick Norton.
Hey, I am Robert Herron.
And I'm thinking about one thing right now.
What?
I don't remember. Okay. No, I think it was those $400,000 speakers we saw at CES last year.
Oh.
Your $400,000 speakers, no matter how beautiful the cabinetry, should not be outshone by products that cost a 400th of the price.
They didn't sound like they were worth any more than, say, the Vandersteen 5 series or Series 5.
They didn't sound as good as the Vandersteen Series 5.
For a lot less money. They were works of art in terms of those speakers. Oh. I don't even remember the name of the company. I think it was the Netherlands somewhere. Yeah. It was beautiful looking. I was more impressed by the fanboyism of the person in there trying to do a video related to just capturing the experience of being in the same room as
you
these.
Say fanboy, I say pretentious. I will say, the imaging wasn't great. Person. The soundstage wasn't great.
We've heard better demos.
Yeah, and maybe it was the room.
Could be.
Could be.
It was a hotel suite.
Vandersteen's going to be at CES this year. I'm very excited.
Me too.
Emotiva's going to be at CES this year. AudioQuest is going to be at CES this year. ELAC's going to be there. More people than I expected in high-end audio.
A few TV companies.
Quite a few TV companies.
Apparently.
The TV companies roll a bit larger and a little bit up more front on press day, but that's okay. That's okay, because they're usually gigantic-ass multinationals.
New washer and dryers? Oh.
Don't mock the new washing machines.
Man, I need my front loader.
Don't mock the front loader. Getting back to the news of technology, I'm actually really curious to hear what Vandersteen has in their room there. I'm curious to hear what ELAC has in their room. I'm curious to hear all the things and to view all the things.
We'll be there.
So we've been waiting for this for months, and out of the blue, Amazon Prime, the app, finally shows up on the Apple TV. And I was laughing because I updated the operating system for one television for my older Apple TV, and it automatically showed up. And the newer Apple TV,
cool.
I had to hunt it down and load it. And, you know, it's Amazon Prime on an Apple TV. And what's kind of funny about this is this finally shows up right around the time Google announces that they're going to pull YouTube access from the Echo Show and possibly the rest of the Fire lineup.
I think they said starting the beginning of the year.
Yeah, they just say January 1, 2018, give or take.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Well, here's the deal, right? Amazon pulled all the Nest devices off of Amazon.
Yeah.
Stopped Nest sales last month. They stopped Chromecast sales like 2 years ago.
Yep. Annoying. So, as a shopper, where I like to just the convenience of shopping on Amazon versus certain products that just fail to appear there,
you know,
and then the reasoning why.
So at the same time, Movies Anywhere is bridging, you know, is allowing us to exchange our titles between iTunes and Amazon Prime and Google Play and Vudu.
Pretty terrific free service.
At the same time that goes on, you know, Amazon's still playing games with YouTube. YouTube's firing shots across the bow of Amazon. And Amazon Prime finally shows up on the Apple TV.
Not quite perfect, though.
No, I only got about a half an hour with it. The thing I was thinking about, I'm gonna have to sit down. So I use Netgear Orbi because the network coverage is fantastic. But
excellent.
The app I have for it doesn't seem to allow me to monitor the bandwidth going to a single device on the network.
Oh,
something you can do in Amplify pretty easily.
Yeah.
Like, hey, it's running this kind of speed.
I literally can flip up in the app and just look at individual devices.
Yeah, and I was kind of curious. Like, I am curious to see if the bandwidth is the same between the Roku and the Apple TV. I'm kind of curious to see what kind of bandwidth they're running. Because there have been times that I felt Amazon Prime's videos were a little softer. But I also know that, you know,
good to put some data behind those observations.
I like data.
Yeah.
A little objective data is a nice
thing. If you're running at a consistent resolution and other aspects that should be similar.
It should be consistent.
I know within at least the Apple TV you have the ability to pull up an overlay that says, you know, what is the resolution of this streaming content? Is it HDR, SDR, or yada, yada, yada?
It was, yeah. So I will do some more of that for next week. I mean, one, the app worked. It's a super simple app. There's basically no settings you can change inside the app on the Apple TV. You run it, you play your movies, you play your Prime stuff. Like I said, the video looks a shade on the compressed side. I didn't have a lot of time with it because, like, basically it was... There was the holiday party for Hack 5 and my wife and I got to go. There was a babysitter involved. It was cool.
Nice. But I will say, going back to the Prime update now for Apple TV, the folks over on Reddit were reporting that you're, at least on the audio side, you're only getting 2.1 channel audio with anything, even if it was encoded in Dolby Digital or 5 multi-channel audio. That, and they're implying that the resolution does not look as good as, say, being delivered from a 4K box, like, say, a game console, which to this day I found any of the game consoles, when as a media player, are among the very best devices. They seem to have the horsepower. The app development on that particular platform seems more consistent. Right. And it seems like at least the Prime app for Apple TV has a little bit more polishing to do before it gets up there with some of the better streaming devices out there.
I'm curious to see how this rolls over time, because I can't decide if this took so long. Because we started hearing about this summer. It's, you know, a biscuit before the end of the year.
It's coming.
It finally shows up. And you know, it doesn't seem particularly, you know, it functions, you know, you hit a button and video plays.
It's there.
But there's not a lot of granular control. We'll see.
Totally.
We'll see if they do updates. We'll see what happens over time. We'll see if they yank it. We'll see, you
keep
know,
our eyeballs on it and our earballs.
If that, let me go to Amazon.com real quick.
Don't do it.
No, it's okay. I have Prime. Apple TV. Oh, good. Yeah. Amazon. Oh, there's the... Oh, wait. That's right. Because all new... The first thing you see is you're showing results for Apple TV. And the first thing you see is the all new Fire TV with 4K Ultra HD and Alexa voice remote in a box. And you see Amazon's choice is the Apple TV mounts. And you see a universal dock. And yeah, they don't sell the Apple TV on Amazon either. Huh.
Unsurprised.
So, you know, I who knows? Maybe there was some change irking going on between, you know, Apple and the Amazon Prime.
Oh, one other quick thing in that tvOS 11.2 update that came out recently, too. They have finally fixed it for the folks that would like to not have HDR enabled all the time. Maybe it was making some of their content a little blown out or a little too colorful or not quite correct mapping. And technically, it's nice now to go into the menus and you can actually, under, I believe, the match content setting, you can now match the dynamic range of the source material to the display device, so it's not simply converting everything to an HDR-like luminance range. And that is just nice. That's kind of the way it should be. There's also frame rate matching support as well, built in as well. Right. So if you're looking at 24 frame per second content and the TV supports 24 frame per second input, that's just simply a better way of watching it. It gives you more cinematic style presentation that's just more accurate, rather than doing some kind of, say, 3:2 conversion in order to get 24 to match a 60 hertz display or something like that.
And something worth pointing out is the difference in between using Movies Anywhere on the Apple TV versus using the Amazon Prime app is you get all of the free Amazon Prime content, video content on the Prime app, and you only get the movies that you have purchased on Movies Anywhere.
Gotcha.
Wouldn't it be nice, though, if you got all of the available streaming movies from all the different platforms?
I think I understand why they don't, but...
The licensing, I can't imagine the licensing in that situation. Best value UHD Blu-ray player with Dolby Vision.
That's still kind of a tough question to answer right now.
Right.
There's this one. Well, let's start with LG. LG has at least two ultra high def players that support the playback of Dolby Vision discs. A couple of those players are under $200, roughly. However, the main complaint I hear about every stinking one of them is how noisy these are as playback devices. The disc mechanism is simply too loud for any player in today's day and age.
Why?
That's a good question.
Are they spinning that fast?
Not necessarily. I think it's more of an engineering thing and how it was designed. You go and look at more premium players, like a $500 player from Oppo, their 203, or the new 205 that just came out for, I think it's a cool $1,200. those have particularly quiet mechanisms. But is there more of a happy medium? Is anybody doing a player that at least it supports that Dolby Vision content on disk and streaming sources too, if you want to do it within the player, as well as, you know, regular UHD Blu-ray? And the Philips BDP7502 is such a player. However, as of right now, it's awaiting a firmware update that was originally scheduled for a couple months ago to be out already to add this Dolby Vision support. Now, according to the company's webpage for this particular product, they're now claiming it is scheduled for Q1 2018. So while there is a quieter player than the LGs out there for about the same amount of money, that $200 price point, that supports your Dolby Vision and HDR10 disc playback, this firmware is still not out yet. So hopefully that will launch in the next month or two, because it would be nice to have more a better selection of players at better price points in terms of having that Dolby Vision and HDR10 disc support. Just so you can, if you want to start investing in arguably the best UHD content today, which would be the titles, the few titles that are encoded in Dolby Vision with that dynamic metadata system for improved contrast performance on a greater range of TVs, it would just be nice to have a player simply that would play that back for you. And if a TV manufacturer, I've noticed, doesn't support Dolby Vision playback on their TVs, that company's ultra-high-def Blu-ray players tend to ignore that feature as well. So
interesting.
So I'm looking to the third parties. I wish we could all have Oppo players. however, I understand budgets, and, you know, maybe the game console is the way to go. I haven't read up on noise measurements for the Xbox One or One S to see how noisy that is during disc playback. It can't be any worse than the last generation of Xbox units, the Xbox One.
This is part of the reason why all of my AV gear is controlled via RF and locked in a closet.
That's the other solution, too. Simply get the box out of the room, if you can, or at least contain that noise.
Contain the noise.
Sometimes that's the way to go.
You know, I'm going to stop right now before I go on a long side conversation about how important it is to quiet down your listening environment, whether you're talking about home theater or audio.
An AV cabinet can help.
Yes, it can. Ohm settings for AV101 this week. Dan writes in, "Hi, I just got my first Marantz AV receiver, the SR6011, and I'm pairing it with the Pioneer Andrew Jones design speakers. The speakers are listed at 6 ohms. When reading through the Marantz manual, it says to set the receiver to 6 ohms when using 6 ohm speakers. Should I set it to the 6 ohms or leave it at 8 ohms?" So,
talking about resistance, baby.
Yeah. Ohm is a measurement of resistance.
Specifically talking about the speaker's resistance.
Yes.
In this case, and you have a set of speakers that are more resistive but can possibly deliver improved audio quality with the right gear driving it.
The classic kind of description here is, imagine your audio is water flowing through a pipe. And as the ohm value increases, the width of the pipe, the diameter of the pipe increases. You can you can run more juice through it. And a lot of times you find, you know, subwoofers and audiophile speakers tend to kind of, or more high-end speakers tend to find in that 4-ohm or 2-ohm range. Subwoofers in the 2-ohm range occasionally. Audiophile speakers start dipping their toe into the 4-ohm range. And you'll see a lot of amplifiers that have 8-ohm and 4-ohm ratings, where the 4-ohm rating may be almost twice what the 8-ohm rating is. So when you look through the conversations about this, right, the manufacturer rates an amplifier to perform with a particular speaker load in terms of the ohm rating.
Generally 8 ohms.
Yeah, generally 8 ohms. Most speakers, 99% of them are 8 ohms. And the problem is you know, many of them will run 4-ohm speakers just fine.
Some even have a switch on the back specifically for that.
And the switch on that is almost invariably to reduce the amount of output power so that the amp doesn't fall on its face.
Under testing by usually groups that are out there just checking the electrical characteristics to make sure the thing won't burn your house down.
Yes.
Literally.
The manufacturer and the UL certification really emphatically, intensely want you to set the if there's a switch in on the back of the AV receiver, or if there's a setting inside the AV receiver, they want you to set it to the ohm rating of the speaker for the children.
Yeah.
For the safety.
Not for the audio quality.
No. You know, the problem some people feel, and generally speaking, that's what you should do. Because most amplifiers that have one of those switches basically know they are going to run out of power when you push a 4-ohm speaker at higher levels.
Let's clip my performance.
By flipping
a switch.
Yeah. I mean, imagine, if you will, you're driving a dragster. You've got a 1,000-horsepower engine, and about halfway down the drag strip, the fuel gets cut off. That's essentially what's happening. There's a big crescendo. You're listening to the Ninth Symphony, and all hell's breaking loose, and all of a sudden, wah!
So I think then, and based on what I've read about this too, it is more important to simply set up the speakers correctly with a subwoofer,
yeah,
almost always, so you can direct the sound that requires the most energy to create to that sub and effectively minimize that the hardest of the load of the audio going to a regular speaker.
Right.
And that will keep you out of trouble. And I know of no amp that I've read a review on or read stuff online about where setting that, if there is an ohm selector switch on the back, right, for your speaker setup, it is almost invariably mentioned to simply not mess with that at all. Leave it at 8 ohms and make sure your main speakers are all set to small.
Right.
And then direct all that other energy at whatever crossover point you decide to the sub. And that will take care of itself that way. That will maintain the full dynamic range capability of the amp or the AVR.
Because generally speaking, the switch for between like 8-ohm and 4-ohm speakers or 6-ohm and 12-ohm speakers, you know, you're fine to run a 12-ohm speaker at 8 ohms, or, you know, a 6-ohm speaker at 4 ohms. That's fine.
Totally.
But what happens when you flip that switch in the back of your AV receiver is that you limit the power output of the amplifier.
Totally.
Which basically reduces the performance of the amplifier, which is kind of exactly what you don't want. You know, whether or not your amplifier is going to explode and burn your house down, I would generally say it is not. However, I am also going to say to you that I am not a lawyer, I am not an electrical engineer, and I'm not going to pay, you know, to replace your house if it burns down. So, you know, take a little personal responsibility. And also take a really strong look at the amplifiers you're buying. You know, if you think you're going to have a particularly difficult load, buy an amplifier that can pump out the juice to drive that load.
Or simply use the pre-outs available on many of these AVRs and then get a separate amplifier for it if that's some road you want to go down and experiment that way. But I think for most people, it's more about set those speakers to small.
Yeah.
Direct that low frequency, the energy for that takes so much more compared to the rest of the efficiency of dealing with the higher frequencies. Mm-hmm. Send that to the sub effectively and have that sub that's made to, usually it has its own built-in amplifier too for dealing with that. And that's kind of the my short take on what to do with that.
Yeah, I mean, because ohm ratings on speakers, that number they give you is an average. Impedance curves aren't flat. They go up, they go down. It's complicated and it's messy, and that number is a ballpark value to allow you to function within the real world without having to, you know, carry around a lot of sophisticated processing technology to connect your speaker to your amplifier.
I agree.
And we are oversimplifying here, but it's one of those subjects where you can get deep into the weeds almost instantaneously. You know, 4-ohm speakers are probably going to rip the snot out of your $300 AV receiver, or if you've got like the $100 special that you found on eBay.
Something you've always told me too. Having more efficient speakers is one way to avoid these potential problems. It's just anything above, say, the high 80s.
Yeah.
And you get some speakers out there now that are in the 90% efficiency range. It doesn't take a lot of power to drive those very, very well. So.
No, but, I mean, the there's a set of Tekton mini lures in the warehouse right now that are 90, 91 dB efficient. That means with 1 watt of power, you are getting 91 decibels of audio out of the front of that speaker.
Plenty.
It's more than enough to do damage
plenty.
If you keep it going for a long time. You know, I don't know. Brent Butterworth has been writing a lot for LifeWire lately, and he talked about speaker impedance earlier this year. It's a great article. He kind of sums it up, you know, it might be okay to put 4-ohm speakers on your 8-ohm, you know, your cheap 8-ohm rated AV receiver. But, quote, crank it up and the pump, the amplifier might not have the power to feed the bigger pipe, the speaker. Best case, the receiver will shut itself off temporarily. Worst case, you'll be burning up receivers faster than a NASCAR driver wears out engines. So,
just during their burnouts.
Yeah, just tear it all apart. But, yeah, I mean, yeah, I think your 6-ohm speakers will be fine on the 8-ohm setting.
I would suggest that over if there is a switch internal to or external to, you know, to drop your voltage.
If you just dropped a bunch of coin on some speakers that are rated at 4-ohm.
I think the potential for degrading the audio output is greater if you start messing around with those settings.
Yeah,
rather than
it's probably at that point time to upgrade your amplification. So,
agreed.
Oh, my goodness. The so much going on in speakers. So exciting. We got a whole bunch of tweets to at AVXL this week. Stephen Corvo, actually, No Thumb Bowler, had a really good one. He tweets at Robert Heron and Patrick Norton, purchase an LG 65-inch OLED B-Series this Christmas or wait until CES and see. If I decide to purchase the 2017, is there a time when the prices will drop again? I missed out on the $500 Canadian savings during Black Friday. And that's a great question because there's TVs come out, and the prices, they tend to either stay stable or they tend to, you know, drop over time, which is great. We love that. And then as the supply runs out, as the channel runs out of that particular model of television, especially if the next year's televisions aren't out, you tend to see a spike in the price. So when they're down to that last few hundred models in the United States, all of a sudden the price goes up to MSRP or higher.
There you go.
And then they sell out, and then you can't find it, and it's kind of a moot point. If a model doesn't sell particularly well, and the next year's models come out, which usually starts in May, or like we see them at CES, they start rolling out in April, May, June. They're hot and heavy all summer. The discounts are starting, should be hitting if they're going to hit at all by the end of the summer. You know, and then we have the big sale on Black Friday. I've been told Boxing Day in Canada, I say Canada with affection, and respect, is another good time to track sales. Here in the United States, of course, the big sale after Black Friday is around or leading up to the Super Bowl.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That, well, I think will be the last option for seeing at least historically the lowest prices we've seen so far on some of our favorite screens.
Yeah.
So
if you're...
And as of right now, the prices you could buy something for today aren't dramatically more than they were during Black Friday.
Yeah,
and maybe $100, $200, $300 for some of the bigger screens in that mid $2,500 range.
Yeah, I mean the worst case scenario is you're like, I have to upgrade now.
Yeah,
I buy a television before Christmas. I have the television during Christmas. I have the television during, you know, hopefully you have some time off on New Year, and then I'm listening to AVXL when Robert and Patrick are recording at CES, and I find out that LG's released the Super B, which has twice the awesome for half the money. And, you know, if you're lucky, you've got a place that has a 90-day return window and you can return it then. Or because if you do return it then, here's the thing, right? We're going to tell you about something at CES and it'll be glorious or it'll be awful or we'll have giant question marks because there's been a lot of marketing foo-rah. And, you know, marketing foo-rah on a hand-selected screen with a limited amount of content and the perfect presentation environment that's designed to make us go, oh, it's glorious. And
we're in probably the worst place to try to look at screens in general. Although they do have darkened areas for specific technology demonstrations, it's in no way representative of, in my opinion, what makes it to even the show floor.
Yeah.
Not the CES show floor, but I mean your shopping retailer's show floor.
There is an ideal of a particular model of television that is put in a particularly, you know, the best possible... the best possible display in a particularly awful place to watch television on the CES show floor, but it is the like platonic ideal of that television, and then they ship something which hopefully resembles that platonic ideal.
Usually pretty close.
But if you don't, you know, Stefan, if you don't buy that television now, you're not buying a new television till probably May or June. And you'll be buying it pretty close to the top of the price curve on that one.
That's the other thing, too. When the new TVs come out, they will be at full price for at least a month or so before even the first sale occurs, generally speaking. So that's something to keep in mind.
And sometimes you just got to accept the fact that you missed that deal. Or in my case, I missed that pair of speakers on eBay. And life will go on.
I just have flashbacks for what things used to cost in terms of like a 1080p LCD panel back right. in the day. I could now get literally a twice the size, actually far more than that, but I just remember that 46-inch LCD I purchased a long time ago and how much that I spent on that. And I had a good deal on that. But the technology you can get today in terms of like an OLED or a quantum dot emissive or a quantum dot-based LCD or something with full-array local dimming, there are a lot of good options out there. The hard part for me right now is deciding LG really got the price of the OLEDs down, at least in terms of their B series. And I still find the picture quality and the absolute brightness you can get out of something like Sony's 930 series, it's about the same price as a 60. I'm looking at 65-inch screens, and the pricing is very similar. Mm-hmm. And so it comes down to more of, I think, what kind of viewing environment you're sitting in.
Right.
I think the more you have light control in the room, the more you'll appreciate the OLED screen, period. Especially when you watch letterboxed movies. Any of the best LCD screens out there today, even the ones with full-array local dimming, if you sit off-axis a little bit, that performance benefit goes away quickly on the screen. It becomes a little, blacks become a little bit brighter. They're a little like a dirty gray versus on an OLED sitting off axis. You don't have nearly that issue because of how the pixels work. And there are other issues too. OLEDs are not perfect. And one thing I will say about the CES show floor, at least, it is an excellent opportunity to compare and contrast the anti-reflective coatings due to all the insane lighting going on and photography gear people are using to just capture the initial images of what these TVs look like. And for that part, actually, it is pretty useful. So we'll say I'm looking forward to the pain.
Looking forward to the optic searing. Chris writes, the verdict is in. The DACAM combo, the Mach D3 and the Modi 2 from Shit Audio I got is great. I get a very clean sound with little noise. Still can pick it up on old songs, though, and past 75% volume, which is, you know, your older songs were recorded with a higher noise floor, and 75% volume is turned up really high, so I'm not surprised you can hear the noise in the older recordings.
Cool.
It says, the headphones sound super warm and clean with very smooth highs. They're definitely way less harsh than my HD 555s, so the baffles taken out to be more like the 595s. I feel like they might still need a few more days of break-in before they settle down a little. I like loud music, so take that how you will. The setup doesn't give me goosebumps, but it does put a smile on my permanently frowned face. I think that's a win. I'm not happy with the amp having such a huge power brick. I wish they could have figured out a way to include it in the amp. Also, the LEDs are insanely bright white. I don't mind it because the piercing light from my monitor at full brightness all the time drowns them out. Also, they come with nothing other than the brick of a power brick. No USB cable, which at a minimum they should, and no RCAs, which I understand. On the entry-level items, they should come with everything. But I am happy I stepped into this world. One, thank you, Chris, for sending it in. I'm glad you're pleased with the purchase. I know it takes a little bit of trust, a little bit of bravery to trust the weird guys on the podcast and order from a company with a name like Shit.
The fella.
Ears unheard. But I'm glad.
Or in this case,
I'm glad
the Magni and the Modi.
Yeah, well, you know, and a couple thoughts to address a couple of your complaints is there's a reason for big-ass power supplies. And there's reasons for keeping them out of the box. Is one, if you don't put the power supply in the box, you don't have to worry about noise from the power supply creating issues. You don't have to worry about if the power supply dies and the rest of the thing becomes useless. You just buy another brick or another wall wart.
Probably makes localization a little easier, too, for around the world.
There's a whole bunch of stuff going on there. And if you start looking at certain high-end components, you'll often find out, in some cases, yes, in some cases, no, but you'll find out where they will actually separate the entire, you know, everything that turns 120 volts AC into whatever AC or DC voltage that's required inside of the piece of gear is in a separate box or container.
Noisy MOSFETs.
Yeah, and you also get all of the heat from the power supply that's kept out of the main device. So by keeping the power supply out of the device, you make it easy to change. You reduce the amount of parts count and cost inside the device itself. You keep the heat out of there. You keep the RF and the noise out of there. And you basically, it simplifies your design and it makes it easier to achieve your goals for less money. So I don't particularly have, on one hand, I get it because it's like, oh, delete expletive. There's one more brick under my desk to keep away from the other seven bricks under my desk. But on the other side, Shit is designing to the best possible value they can deliver on a given product, right? And you know, spending money on a USB cable means not spending it on the hardware or the design. And, you know, yeah, they could throw a USB cable in every box, but then that money is taken away from, you know, the cost of it. You know, all of their gear is, as much of their gear as possible, is made in the United States.
Cool.
You know, yeah, absolutely cool.
I doubt any USB cables are made in the U.S.
I doubt they are made in the U.S. Yeah.
At least terminated.
Yeah.
Very unlikely.
Well, you can get some terminated cables, but the...
I guess that wouldn't bug me too much, considering how inexpensive they are.
Yeah.
That, and chances are I have a couple of spare mm-hmm. cables laying around that it's always nice to get rid of, but not everyone's like me, you know, saving every last cable and dongle that comes with a product just in case. Here are some 15-year-old HDMI cables that I'll never use again, but give them away.
Yeah, and at this point, like, I would rather go on to Amazon and buy yet another Anchor cable.
Oh yeah,
because
picked up a couple more of theirs.
Yeah, I'm like you. I've got I've got a drawer full of cables at the office. I've got a box full of cables at home, and at this point, I don't need another USB cable. But on the other hand, I get it. If it was a weird USB cable,
I wear out those
awesome
micro USB cables just from use.
That's
the only ones that seem to hold up are the ones you spend a little mm-hmm. bit more on. So
I will say Anchor does a fantastic job on their USB cables. The less stuff they put in there, the more money they can spend on the product that you actually listen to.
Definitely.
So I think that's pretty fantastic. I should also point out that, you know, for example, like on the Fullo 2, which costs $99, if you don't like it, you've got 15 days to return it. They do a 15% restocking fee, which on one hand, I get why people find that irritating. On the other hand, this is a company that's trying to, you know, keep margins to a minimum, and they don't want to turn into the recycling hardware tryout place. And Shit does an amazing job of showing up at all sorts of audio events, Rocky Mountain Audio Fest, Can Jam events all over the country, where you can get a chance to listen to their gear ears on.
I know you're a great customer. However, there are some.
There are some who might abuse that. Nothing wrong with that. And, you know, with some of their more expensive products, for example, here's the Lear 2. If you don't like it, simply send it back for a refund minus a 5% transaction fee. You know, they're basically trying to, because, you know, if they run your card and send you something, you know, they're at the cost, the percentage for the credit card company, the time of the warehouse person, the time to ship it, and then they get back a used product that they can't sell as new. So I can see where they might be a little, they might be a little chill about that. But yeah, I mean, for the super cheap products, you know, there's like a 15% restocking fee. For the more expensive products, they do a 5% transaction fee to cover their losses on the credit card transactions, which I think is reasonable. But, you know, I am a small business, so I might be more gracious about that.
Understood.
P.S., by the way, that verdict, he says, is for initial thoughts, not long-term thoughts. So, Chris, email us as you get more time on station with us and let us know what you think. Evan Adams tweeted, do you prefer the THX 36-degree distance or the SMPTE 30-degree distance? Are we talking about speakers or monitors or?
Talking about viewing distance effectively and mm-hmm. how close do you want to be to the screen to give you, in the case for THX, they're recommended, I believe this is correct, the 36-degree of field of view. And versus, say, a more narrow 30-degree field of view as put forth by the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers. Sometimes your choices are simply limited in terms of where you can put your seat to look at the screen that's in front of you, or your selection of a seat within a movie theater in terms of how much of that field of view are you the type of person that would prefer, you know, sitting a little closer so you have more of that content in your face that's taking up a greater portion of your field of view? Or do you prefer to hang back a little bit and maybe see more of the screen with potentially less head turning?
Right.
And I really don't see either one being wrong. It's more about, like I said, for a room setup for somebody's home, you can have it just the way you want it or what you're used to. In terms of, you know, every day when I went to the theater, I always sat up front. Sure. So I couldn't see the edges of the picture. And that's one extreme. The other being I sit in the very back of the room, so my eyes barely have to move to look all over the screen.
I'm I'm at that end of the theater.
I am too. And it's also, for whatever reason, in commercial cinemas, I love sitting in the middle. Right. I just like, maybe it's the audio side of it or whatever, but just something about being in the middle. But anyway, it really does come down to, I think, more personal preference. I don't believe there is a right or a wrong answer for this. And it really is that simple. I think both specs, as far as THX and why they've decided on what they decided upon in terms of sitting a little closer versus Sempty's preference for sitting back a little further, I think those are also related to going back in time to movie theater screens that are generally much larger versus TV screens that are right. generally much smaller. So there's some of that factors in as well. I think it's also being able to perceive enough of the detail on the screen, sitting close enough to where you can take in every pixel, mm-hmm. not individually where you're actually seeing things like artifacts related to that, but enough of it so that whatever detail is being delivered to the screen, you have a chance at least of seeing it. And sometimes maybe that's not ideal. Maybe right. you would rather not be so hypercritical and sit back just a little bit further so things blend a little bit more. You know, that it's, if there is a more personal setting than how close you sit to the screen, I don't know it. I see it all over the map.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at it, also there's like maximum and minimum THX viewing distances, and their maximum is like a 26 degree.
Completely.
You know, their minimum is a 36 degree. Sempty splits the difference at 30 degrees.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about some pretty subtle stuff. It's the difference between, well, you know, the difference between 26 degrees and 36 degrees is 4 feet.
Yes.
You know, and I don't think either one of those is going to particularly, you know, upset me.
I'm in general setups, I'm less concerned about the viewing distance as long as it's not going to some crazy extreme that's affecting yeah. the overall, you know, the person's enjoyment of it. It's more literally about the picture quality, mm-hmm. Getting the contrast as good as possible for yeah. that given room environment. Seeing that the colors are being processed accurately and delivered to your eyeballs with, you know, to give you the most realistic, or at least to use as many of the senses that your eye can perceive in terms yeah. of color reproduction to give you the best chance of seeing it in its best light.
Yeah, and again, it's really subtle, right? 11 feet to my 90-inch screen, or 12 feet to my 90-inch screen is 30.5 degrees. And 11 feet to my 90-inch screen is 33 degrees. You know what I mean? So we're talking, it's pretty subtle.
Yeah.
Sit where you can.
Exactly. which of those two seating distances is most comfortable? Which would you enjoy?
If you've got a room you can make that level of changes in without, you know, without that's the problems, that's even better.
Exactly.
Rayshaw tweeted about the differences with LG's 2017 OLED models. What's the main difference between the LG E7 and the C7 besides the glass and the soundbar on the E7? Is the picture quality the same? And, you know, the B7A drops internal Dolby Atmos decoding.
Yeah, the most value of all of their right. OLEDs for 2017.
But that doesn't mean you can't run Dolby Atmos on an AV receiver with your AV speakers. It just means Dolby Atmos isn't being done
internally, and I believe that would also imply that it's not like, say, if you're running the app in the TV,
right.
you wouldn't be able to direct a Dolby Atmos soundtrack okay. out of it, just for that entry level B7A.
Look, we've got another reason to ignore the operating system inside the television.
The C7 is a step up above the B that does incorporate internal right. Dolby Atmos decoder,
but the same glass and the same processing.
Yes, that's the key. It's the exact same OLED panel, the exact same OLED emitters, the same color filter on top of that OLED stack. It's similar across the whole line from the B all the way up to the E and the W. They're all using effectively the same OLED materials, same panel processing, and you should have effectively very, very similar image quality, especially after selecting, you know, like similar presets and sure. things like that. No real difference. And that, thank goodness, that's just one less thing I have to think about, at least looking at LG's 2017 lineup for their OLEDs. There's a lot less difference. I personally prefer that picture on glass design that mm-hmm. LG has come up with. I think it not only looks good, I think it just offers a level of rigidity that you simply don't have for an OLED panel on, say, a plastic-backed TV. Or goodness knows, I would take the chances with something like the W, the wallpaper model. And it's It's slight flexibility. It's not made to be flexible.
Robert loves the wallpaper model.
It's fun to pull up the corner on that with that magnetic backing, and it's slight. Oh, it's so thin and lovely, but I really want that W with just a simple breakout box. And I'll be curious. I'll be really curious to see what the 2018 version of that TV will do. If they do something like that, or they stick with the gigantic soundbar still. I want the option to go either way.
I'm not feeling the 2mm love. I actually like the Samsung frame a lot more.
Oh, you know, just in terms of doing artwork on TVs, that crap's been around for a long time. But it really wasn't until we had very high contrasted 4K screens. Mm-hmm. And with the wide viewing angle of OLED, these things look good doing it.
It's not
convincing.
Even about, I mean, the art display is nice. I was actually just more into having the frame around the television and not having a big giant.
Oh, that one frame design. Samsung has some good style stuff. I will give it to them for that. Man, they make some interesting things in terms of their base designs. Mm-hmm. They have everything from some really clever... not only like easel style stands to one that's just simply a solid weight in the middle that kind of allows the TV to float there. They give you some options for stuff like that. And everyone was pushing basically a way to flush mount these TVs to the wall with usually a custom bracket for it. So a lot of little things like that in addition to just great performance. It's not bad. But the beauty of the OLEDs for this year, pick the one that you like. And you will have similar image quality across the board. It comes down to more of the styling.
Right.
And in the case of the B7A, the lack of a Dolby Atmos decoding.
Internally.
But they all still have Dolby Vision. And all the HDR10 and HLG and Technicolor Expert. And
Super Ponies.
I'm telling you, the menu options in those OLEDs, when you start getting into the OLED modes, it's like, HDR game mode. Should I select Technicolor Expert versus the calibrated mode? Or, it has a separate calibrated mode for the HDR. And there are like 8 million little settings in those TVs. There's and still two places to apply settings to all inputs. It's like, you go into a submenu, apply all of these settings to the inputs. Oh, wait, you go up a couple menus. Here's another one that says the exact same thing. Actually, they do differentiate them slightly, but...
Slightly.
I kid.
Glad it's there. You calibrate a lot of televisions for a living. You're not kidding. You're
just
irritated.
Just the quirky things. That was one other thing. I dealt with a repeat client last week who got rid of a Sony 930. Uh-huh. I think it was the D model. Last year's solid, great TV. And they replaced it for an LG OLED. And the main reason was app performance. Android TV on Sony televisions seems dog slow, at least over time. Or,
really?
maybe I hear that a lot. And that is one thing I will be looking forward to seeing at CES. These TV manufacturers need to ensure they're providing ample CPU power in these sets for down the road updates and things like that. It can't be just good enough right when it ships if in like 6 months a couple updates just turn it into a bucket of molasses on a frozen day. I'm telling you.
Apple TV.
I'm telling you. I love
Android TV.
I love these Roku TVs. I don't.
Or just an external box.
Yeah, that in particular.
Don't be fussed. I'm still
angry at Sony for not supporting ultra high def Blu-ray. I wanted a PlayStation 4 with Blu-ray player, ultra high def Blu-ray player.
Wasn't much to
Sony
ask
just
for.
Mocks me. No, they don't. They'll probably let it go.
Yeah. Breathe. Okay. Speaking of television calibration and angst, was there any angst with the new version of Portrait Display's Calman?
No, I need to actually load that up. That just dropped, I think, last night, and it's incorporating a new method of testing color differences in HDR video, something that they worked in conjunction with Dolby Laboratories over. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that the way color is currently mapped on these TVs, there is no set standard. And the big deal about this new metric and these tests for doing color differences in HDR video is that this new standard is more applicable to the actual color that we can see as human beings.
Right.
And providing, I think, a more consistent metric. And in terms of calibration and setup, this kind of color mapping has the potential to decrease the error potential of, like, when you start getting into high bit color sampling and subsampling and things like that. Not by a lot, but say, you know, if you had 10-bit information coming in and after being processed in the old system, you could effectively end up with some rounding errors and certain color combinations and things like that. With this other way of doing it, at least, and let me just give you the full technical name for this. I'll say once ICTCP. We'll talk about this later, but it is, I think it's going to be a good method of not only better representing the color performance that in terms of from TV to TV after measurements are taken, and then beyond that, it will hopefully also provide just improved calibration compared to the current error measurements I'm using with today's software. So it's a little nerdy tweak, but this is the first step. And I really haven't seen any talk of this yet since we were discussing it, I want to say 10 months ago,
right,
back at Dolby Labs when they kind of introduced this system. Now I'm actually seeing it implemented in software, and I'm looking forward to seeing how much better we can make these new HDR displays and these wide color gamuts map properly to the content we're trying to enjoy.
Nothing wrong with that.
No.
Super Patty, a.k.a. Patrick Price, tweets, what's the best line that you use to get your wife to go along with a not-quite-necessary TV upgrade? Reference, I have a 52-inch LED non-smart TV from 6 years ago.
I don't think you're laughing at the TV.
No, I'm laughing at the question. It's so one of the things my dad taught me.
Don't break someone else's budget.
No. Look, if the TV works, don't fix it. But and there's nothing wrong with waiting for a particularly appropriate moment. It's like jiu-jitsu. You wait for the right moment. One of the things my dad taught me is when you buy a treat for yourself, you buy a treat for your wife, and which worked for the most part fairly well for him.
Good to know.
I should also point out that my dad once brought home 300 frogs, not live frogs, but bought someone's frog collection to literally distract my mom during a rather unhinged phase of our house restoration back in Pennsylvania. My father's advice, while often incredibly useful, you must understand there was a degree of intensity and mayhem that came with it that you may not want to get yourself involved with. 300 frogs. What's mom going to do with 300 frogs? I don't know, son. They're her frogs. And, you know, oddly enough, it distracted her enough that, you know, we were able to finish the repair and cleaning up the repair that had started right after she had cleaned the entire house before half of our family showed up for Thanksgiving. So there's a lot of story going on there.
You can swing an OLED, I think that would just about convince anyone who sees it, especially going from a 52-inch LCD.
I found certain content that my wife loves gains me some slack. Because my wife, years ago, like almost 10 years ago now, was it?
Maybe
goodness,
you could
has been
cut
that
cable
long?
And go with OTT services? Or
well, it was... It
no,
was...
I'm just... How would I do it?
You know, the
lucky what I did. The forgiveness.
Oh my goodness. Well, yeah, I once accidentally bought a 5,000-pound diesel powered pickup truck on eBay, and I still don't know how I didn't get thrown out of the house for that one. But we had actually just moved into a place, and I've hauled 37,000 pounds of debris and yard waste out of the house with it. So
and you finally did get rid of a vehicle, I think.
Yeah, I finally got rid of a vehicle. What? I have vehicle collection issues. Deal with it. For her, like, there's some BBC stuff that she loves, and she saw the BBC miniseries of Pride and Prejudice with Colin Firth and everybody, and that was for her. That was the moment where she was like, wow, this is really neat. And, you know, once she had that epiphanal experience where she saw the glories of the 1080p projector at 90 inches, she was in. I also thoroughly enable my wife's cat and sewing machine addictions because my wife routinely comes home with another cat. Possibly because our cats occasionally get run over by vehicles and such. So there's openings in the facility. But, work it out, Patrick. Is there something she wants? Is there a negotiation to be made? Is it something she'll appreciate? Does she do movie nights? Do you need
she a gamer?
She a gamer?
She need that new Xbox console?
Yeah, get her an Xbox console and tune up that surround sound system. And,
Maybe a piece of furniture. I don't know what this person.
Yeah, we
what
don't
they're
know
into.
Your wife.
No,
but we can give you. You know, sometimes you just go for it and see if it ends up in divorce. Not my personal recommendation, but hey.
Oh no. Yeah, don't go down that road. That will supersede the cost of whatever TV upgrade you're planning.
Yeah.
And, you know, a couple orders of magnitude.
Yeah. You know, it is what it is. But
get the best deal on it.
I'm probably going to say don't go with 300 frogs, but, you know.
Maybe not.
Give it a shot, man. You know, get her. What does she want that she does not have that you can provide to distract her?
A good wall mount so you're not hogging the best place to view the screen.
Trip to the keys.
Do whatever it takes.
Yeah, do what you got to do, man. Or just live with your. Because the other thing is, like, you know, that 52-inch LED is, you know, yeah, I get it. You want something bigger. You want 4K. You want HDR.
That'll be such a nice upgrade. I mean, that's a person who's waited a while.
Yes, waiting a while makes a much bigger difference than getting a TV every other year.
It's going to be more than 2x visually speaking. The improvements.
We shouldn't say that. CEA will block us from entering CES this year. You said not to upgrade your television every year.
Oh.
You must leave. Vile podcast personalities.
Exactly. What do they know?
They know they want to sell more stuff.
Oh, no. That I understand.
But. That's the only thing you need to understand. I kid, but I'm mostly serious. I mean, yeah, you know, it's going to be a huge upgrade. And the other thing is, if you wait till after CES, you give yourself months. You see what you want to buy, you know, see what we find at CES, make your decision, and then you can plan a multi-month campaign between then and when the TV actually ships.
It's coming.
You know? I don't know.
That's a good plan. A
couple of bottles of wine.
I've had nothing to really offer this person. Mr. Price.
Good luck, sir.
Super Patty.
Good luck, sir.
Seriously.
Yeah, and sometimes you get a bonus. Like your wife listens to a set of AudioQuest Nighthawk headphones and goes, why don't our living room speakers sound like this? And then you get some living room speakers that sound like this, and then she keeps moving them so they don't sound
right.
You know,
that might be one thing to consider, too. If you're planning on using the TV speakers,
right.
Stop right there and make sure you at least get an affordable soundbar or something just to – TV speakers suck.
Yeah.
and anything is an upgrade over what it comes built in.
Let's not increase the hit on Mr. Price's bank accounts. Let's get him the screen he wants. Good
luck,
sir. With that, ladies and gentlemen, AV Excel is the podcast you've been listening to. We love home theater gear. We love audio gear. We love good content. And we want to help you get the best experience you can from your audio and video, which is why you should head over to avxl.com. You got all the links to subscribe to the show. And if you really like the show, we could use your support. Patreon.com/AVXL. You subscribe. We'll give you some treats at patreon.com/AVXL. There's hangouts if you contribute at a higher level. And we're going to try to think. I think we're going to manage to do a hangout at CES this year.
That would be cool.
We're working out the scheduling on that.
For the people that are directly responsible for making the show possible.
Because without you, we can't do it. And
we appreciate it.
How you listening, there's not much point in us doing this. We just go to a bar and talk about this crap. Or I could, you know.
Look, you.
God damn it, Robert. It's time to watch John Wick Chapter 2. The
Rack the. Never mind.
Tap, rack, bang. Thank you guys and gals for listening. We really appreciate that. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I'm Robert Herron.
We'll catch you next week on AVXL.